I had the pleasure of speaking to Nino Birch of Beat Rhythm Fashion. They originated in 1981 they released three singles, Turn of the Century, No Great Apes, and Being's Rest. Finally, took a 30-year break and then have started releasing music again. We talked about basically everything, their latest albums, Critical Mass and Tenterhook, and also what they were getting up to in the early 80s.
Okay. I don't have a copy of that. I actually don't have a copy of any of the CDs, any of the records. CDs, of course. I've got the latest CDs.
No, I think my dad checked on Discogs or something, and they're going for $450 or not.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Not that I'm parting with them, but it's crazy.
Yeah, I couldn't afford to buy my own record.
No. Yeah.
That's my mad dog. Can you hear the dog? It's not too loud, is it?
No.
Dog
can't
barking.
Hear the dog.
Okay, cool. So when I record, I just have to hope the roosters don't. Don't go bonkers, or the dog doesn't bark, or, you know, it's pretty organic. It took a long time. None of it could happen without Rob. I basically send the guitar stems to him. I send the vocal stems to him. He'll say, yeah, that sounds great. He'll send it. He'll then send me a click track to work my ideas through with. So everything has to be done to a click track, obviously. And then I'll fly back to him the vocal and guitar track that he then puts bass to. And if we're lucky enough to be able to work with Caroline, she will put drums on as she did in the first album. But this album, Critical Mass, Caroline was too busy. So we just intuited the BRF drumming style. We basically built it up from a fairly stripped back rhythm, and then he developed. So it's an incredible job on his part, in my view.
So it was just you and Rob working on Critical Mass and Caroline.
Critical Mass was Rob and I.
Right.
Caroline, I'd need to confirm it. There may be a song there where part of her drumming might be in, but I don't think so. We're doing other releases where her drumming will be on, because they're historical archival revamps.
Right.
So we've got an album coming out pretty soon, which is...
Oh, exciting.
They're reinvigorated BRF tunes. So I've actually done a new version of Turn of the Century.
No way.
Yes way. And I'm pretty proud of it. I think it's a damn fine piece of music now, and it always was, but it's got some grunt in it. It builds at the end and becomes pretty powerful.
Oh, that's so exciting. Fun fact about me, that's my favorite song. As soon as my dad played it for me, I was like, that's my new favorite song, and it's kind of stuck with me. I did want to ask you more about the time during the 80s when you were initially releasing. I was wondering how you got started making music with your brother.
Well, I mean, we played music together historically for years and years. You know, by the time I was 12, he got me into guitar. I started playing guitar. We were Beatles fans, Beatles, Bowie, all the English bands, really, even Pink Floyd, mostly the Beatles, Small Faces, Cream, all those kinds of sounds. John Lennon was our musical hero, and also, like, you know, ideologically, I connected with what John was about, you know. We played together from childhood, and then in the end, we were both at university. I was like maybe 18 or 19. I was at uni doing law. Dan was nearly finished his law degree. We were still playing music and playing in pubs. He was playing in various bands. I wasn't so much, but I'd play jam with him. I don't think I actually publicly played in a band, particularly before we did BRF.
Right.
I occasionally got up and played piano and stuff like that at a pub, but Dan did for a while play in various bands. And then we just decided one day to pack it in. We hit the road and hitchhiked, from memory, and we both quit university. My dad was pretty pissed about that, but because Dan only had about maybe half a year to go, or a year to finish his law degree, but he was never going to be a lawyer. So we quit academia, put some money together. I got a guitar. He bought a guitar, bass, guitar. He was actually a brilliant guitarist, Dan, like a way better guitarist than me, but we needed bass, so he slotted into that job. I took on the guitar, but together we often played together on guitar, but never as BRF. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Our ideal would have been to have a bassist and both Dan and I on guitar, but it didn't work out that way. So
no.
And it's a good thing. I don't have regrets about that. It's a good thing. It was a good three piece.
No, I find it astonishing that there's only three of you, because the sound that is produced is is so much depth to it.
We were pretty keen on getting a full sound, and we were lucky enough with BRF. So we started to play. We weren't actually called BRF first. I think actually our first gig was at a place called Billy the Club, and our band was called the West Town Quintet, and it was a strange name. Dan was just being sarcastic. It was during the boot boy punk scene sort of kicking in New Zealand a few years later than England. And then by the time we did the first recording with Life in the Fridge with our friends from 246 The Terrace, we were then called Beat Rhythm Fashion.
How'd you come up with the name?
Well, the idea of the name was Dan's thing. The idea is basically that music is a beat, it's a rhythm, and it's the fashion with which you play it sort of determines your sound. So the name doesn't mean beat, rhythm, fashion, as in fashion, clothing, and or the fashion of the day. It's the old, it's the more sort of literal interpretation of the word fashion. So, you know, you do something in a certain fashion. Do you know what I mean? It's old English, right?
Yeah.
It basically means beat, rhythm, style, I suppose.
Right.
Or beat, rhythm, method, but we just use the term fashion. And we just wanted an open-ended name that wasn't trendy or trying to be groovy. It was just sort of a stamp. Just like other band names I like, for instance, is bands like The, you know, yeah. I think that's a clever name.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah.
We spoke just briefly about the Wellington Zone and those kinds of gigs, and I was just wondering, do you have any interesting stories from that time playing live?
Well, things were pretty wild back then. Yeah, it was a little bit, it was great fun, obviously, and, you know, we were mates with bands, you know, the Gordons, the Steroids. It was a small community of rebels all doing their thing. You know, we were always accused of being a little bit too pretty, a little bit too tuneful. And yeah, we were just the colonial boys from Hong Kong. So we received a fair bit of shit from New Zealand about all of that. And I suppose we asked for it in many ways, to be honest. You know, Dan was a bit of a smart ass, and so was I. And Rob always laughs still to this day about our cheeky or rude comments and the repartee that used to occur when we did live gigs. You know, we didn't shy back from being rude to people if they were going to be rude to us, or even if even we were occasionally rude, whether they were or not.
Yeah.
So you get me. But to be honest, it was the vibe of the times, let's face it. You know, you were just getting up raw and just doing your thing. And if someone didn't like it, well, it wasn't our job to do anything they particularly liked. We were just doing what we did. And if someone had a problem about it, well, you know, fuck off and leave the venue, shut up, listen to the music, or don't be here.
Yeah,
simple as that.
Totally. That's such good perspective. I just wanted to ask, I guess your sound has this dreamlike quality, and I just wondered what kind of inspired that. I know in previous interviews or things that I've read, it's been noted you've been influenced by The Cure, especially Three Imaginary Boys, and I was just wondering, you could speak to that and maybe other influences that you had.
Always Dan and I have always loved melody and also been drawn to being able to evoke that ourselves. The other thing that has always been really important to us is texture. So a multi-layered texture, a good strong bottom end, ethereal ambient things going on, but a full shelf of sound, so nothing too in your face. So I like the idea of the music being beautiful, but also that it has a lyrical edge and a contextual edge, you know. That all the music I've loved, Joy Division, The Beatles, various bands, a Gang of Four, generally they're saying something they mean a lot, that they are saying with full conviction, but they're clothing it in something that's interesting. It's not predictable, and it's not just regurgitated. It's why I've never been into the blues particularly. I really appreciate blues being played beautifully, really well, you know, obviously. But I'm not into going to listen to something that's just being played to you. It's a rehash of everything you've ever heard in your life.
Yeah.
So we just did what we're moved by, you know. The music would just come down from wherever it did. In fact, I have to relearn my songs. It's a real pain. And I've spoken, there I know a number of artists that are like that. We're very much into that aspect of texture, melody, and that's why I loved that album 17 Seconds by The Cure. So that was a very inspirational work for me. I remember when The Cure hit town and their first album, but the album that really moved me was 17 Seconds. We went to that concert, the concert when they were doing 17 Seconds, when that was sort of the main thrust of their drive at the time, because they came a few times. That concert was brilliant for me. I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. So it made it pretty clear to us that when we gigged, we wanted to get a really nice, big, full sound. a lot of bottom end, and we needed someone to do that for us. And we met this guy, Chris Cullinane, out the back of an electrician's shop, I think. We just walked into the back room, and there he was twiddling with speakers and welding something or doing this, that, or the other. And we heard that he built, and we actually got him to make some speakers for us. I'm pretty sure that's what happened. And then in the end, we convinced him to become our sound engineer. And he brought that quality to our live gigs that we probably wouldn't have achieved without him. That's how it happened. It was obviously, it was something that we were driven to try and achieve. Once we sort of developed the BRF journey, we needed a good sound. We wanted to run in stereo. So I ran with two JC120s. So actually at the height of when we were doing a full sound, I used two Roland JC120s, running them in stereo. Chris was really good at getting a nice full drum sound. So yeah, we tended to go for that, like a good big full sound.
You just mentioned that your lyrics often have an edge to them, and I think everyone that listens to them will know that it's never apart from the politics of the time. And I just was wondering if you could tell me a little bit why you were inspired to write about what was going on at the time and still are, because Critical Mass and Tenterhook both seem to follow the same thematic journey.
Yeah, it's true. They're just my sort of core reflections of how I'm perceiving this existence, you know.
Yeah.
It's like what occurs for any artist, I suppose, is that they might be sitting in their room as a painter. Some people paint just something beautiful, but other people paint the guts of what's going on in their heart and reflect it back to you. And I suppose that's all I'm trying to do with music, present how I feel about this life that shapes us. And I do give opinions, though. I won't deny that. There's a definite persuasive bent to what I bring, but I try not to make it too literal. So I try and sort of tell a story, paint a picture, but definitely I am saying this is what we could have or this is what we have.
Yeah.
And I make it pretty clear what I feel about that.
Right.
But I try not to be too, I don't wish to be instructive or dictatorial or, you know, be saying to people, oh, you should do this, you should do that, stop doing this, stop doing that. A lot of music tends to be a little bit I feel Critical Mass is one of my more personal albums, and it definitely is doing that. It's got, you know, the tune about the innocence of war, the children who are suffering this ridiculous warring pastime that we seem to have inflicted on us and have had inflicted on us since time immemorial. And the people who suffer are the people that actually have no vested interest in the war whatsoever, and are basically collateral damage. And that was just something that was moving me at the time. So I wrote that song as from the perspective of, say, a 12-year-old girl, and not necessarily in Gaza. In fact, when I wrote it at the time, I think more the Ukraine thing was going on. But it's certainly, you know, that's something that's existed, a toxic scenario on this planet. And then other tunes might be more personal that might have come to me about, you know, when we were in lockdown and how we communicate. And one of them, it was called Fall and Rise Again, was more inspired by my thinking that I would, if the shit hit the fan, how I would connect with my daughters, and we'd just drive off into the fucking distance, you know, get out of the city.
Yeah.
And that was the one but it became a bigger picture, that song, as they often do. You know, it's inspired by a thought, and then it becomes something greater. All the songs are about our humanity, I think.
Yes.
Basically, ever since I started writing music, me more than Dan, I think Dan's was more geopolitical, a much smarter guy than me when it comes to literary capacity. I've got some stuff Dan's written in a bookshelf down here, and I read it occasionally. And he really he had a beautiful mind. He just couldn't cope with it. But yeah, the whole album is really about our humanity and what we choose to accept, what sort of boundary we want to set for ourselves for this way forward. And I just, I suppose, make it pretty clear what I feel and try to paint a picture for people to breathe into a little bit. But I'm not necessarily saying you need to do this or you need to do that, or at least I try not.
Yeah, no, I definitely feel there's a real kind of emotional core to the album. And I put so many of my friends onto Critical Mass, and we were talking about the album.
Cool.
And just about how I think the political messaging is just like really moving, and it truly makes you obviously there's a certain way to look at world events and through the news and understanding it in that way, but also it's just so important to keep an eye on the art. It brings a different understanding, I think, which
absolutely
is so important.
I think what's occurring in the art world is a barometer for what's actually occurring.
Definitely.
I mean, we're the commentators that are probably a more interesting thing to tune into to get a picture of the condition of the planet. A lot of the most poignant or the greatest art that we get to enjoy, they have been birthed out of some pretty difficult scenarios,
yeah,
some pretty difficult,
yeah,
existence. Yeah. So
you spoke briefly just about your brother, and I just wanted to ask what the experience, I guess, of this is really more of your solo project, and just wondered, what the difference in writing music has been this time around.
The truth is, I mean, I haven't worked with Dan for a long, long time. I came to Australia and I did a demo once with a friend. This was while Dan was still in New Zealand. The stuff I used, the Hunters and Collectors practice room with the band I was playing in for a while. And a singer that I shared a flat with is a beautiful guy called Phil Reed, who lives in New Zealand now, is a close friend of Paul Hester's and from the Crowded House. And Paul played some drumming for me once on a demo and so forth. So I tried to do a few things, but I wasn't gigging as such. And then eventually after, I think, 85, I came over to Australia. About 87, 88, Dan came over. He was pretty messy, and, Dan had been pretty messy. BRF broke up because Dan was messy. I left New Zealand because Dan was messy and I had to get away. So, and that's the tragedy of it all. It's just the way it was. And then when Dan came over, we did get a band together, and we called the band, I can't remember what we called the band, it was the Anvil Chorus, and then we called it The Egg. That was Dan's crazy idea. I won't tell you the longer version of it because it's pretty rude, but we were working with a guy called Des Hefner, who was the drummer from, geez, he's going to hate me for this one, I'm just trying to, Scavengers or the Suburban Reptiles. I'm pretty sure it was the Suburban Reptiles, but gee, I hope I got that right. But Des has played with a few bands, the Marching Girls, and he's quite a legend.
I love the Marching Girls. They're so good.
So he's a Kiwi legend.
Yeah.
And we had a keyboard guy, a young guy called Matt Hayden, and we got this band together, and we actually supported Crowded House on Neil Finn's 30th birthday. And that was a really good gig. We had about 11 songs that we'd put together. Nothing Damaged, which is on Tenterhook, was a song I did with Dan. Dan's lyric in that gig way back then, we did a version of that song. So I just brought that one back to life. So we had a good sound. It was a great, but we did that support and Dan was smashed. And at one stage he was just perched down and sat on the fallback speaker, and just sort of loped along and played the bass. And I looked at him and went, Dan, what are you doing, dude? We broke up after that gig,
Right.
And then after that gig, Dan and I fell out to a degree, and I had to stay away from him because he was too messy. I loved him thoroughly, but he was just substance abuse, mostly alcohol at that time. Dan wasn't a great drinker. When he drank, he was a pain in the neck. And he went and moved to Noosa, and whenever I would go up there, we could play for hours together on our acoustics and so forth. So there was nobody on this planet I could play with like I could play with Dan.
Yeah.
So it's been tragic for me, that couldn't transcend the troubles that living a life with Dan presented. Yeah, that was the journey. We never got BRF back together, Dan and I. We thought about it. We were going to do it, but it just never could happen because of his health and his mental state. And then he basically committed suicide in 2011. So after that, I just started communicating with Rob Mays, and I sent him the odd tune, and he just said, look, slowly but surely, while I was living in New South Wales, about 2016, we started to send recordings to each other. With Rob's help and guidance, we started to get the BRS sound back in happening. We thought about another bassist, and in the end, it just became obvious that Rob played bass, so why the hell wasn't he doing it? Took us nearly 5 years, I think, to get Critical Mass finished after the other one. So, life gets in the way. I have a busy life. He has a busy life. He's got other projects going all the time anyway as well. I'm starting to play more now. I don't just sit down and play like a job. I have to be inspired. So So now it's starting to happen again, and I keep my guitar at the shop. I have a guy drop in and with his cajuns, and we're playing a little bit. I've got some new tunes that are brewing now at last. So we'd like to do another album, but God knows how long it'll take. it can't take long. We got to crack this one pretty quickly if we're going to do it. A whole bunch of material has been sent to New Zealand. So, Rob's, he actually wanted me to plug this a little bit with you, so okay. I should. But JB Hi-Fi now have a whole bunch of BRF CDs and a whole bunch of Failsafe records. You'll be able to buy the hard copies, so CDs, from JB Hi-Fi stores. So there's 23 stores. I'd say it's a nationwide thing. So each major center in JB Hi-Fi, you'll be able to get Critical Mass, Tenderhook, Beings Rest, Finally albums, and also limited numbers of Japanese imports.
Right.
And when you get the discs, you get the free download codes as well. You can get the deluxe booklets and the lyrics and the artwork and photos and so forth.
Amazing. Go buy the album.
Yeah. Yeah, you can walk into a shop and buy the album. So that's good because you haven't been able to do that for a while, except go and pay, like, as you say, $60 to $400 for an old BRF single. Or the four stars one is the rarity that actually attracts a fair bit of dough, I think.
Yes, yeah.
But I'm kind of excited about the new. We're not sure how we're going to bring the new recordings we're doing, what sort of format, but we'd like to do something in the vinyl realm, but I don't sure how that's going to happen. Beings Rest, Finally, Turn of the Century, and a bunch of other BRF classics have been redone. Rob and I have redone them, so
Yes. They'd
be a good listen for some BRF, our old BRF friends from days gone by. I'm certainly looking forward to people hearing Turn of the Century.
Yeah.
And if it isn't the greatest song ever written, that's turn of the century, beat, rhythm, fashion. Thank you so much to Nino Birch for speaking to me. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed listening back to that one, and I hope you did too. I got a text in 5395, hi Nino, from Roger Riot, so that's cool. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break, but yeah, hope you enjoyed that.